Good morning and welcome to Countrywide. On this week's programme, we learn how one Meath archer is targeting her personal best in the Paralympics. We hear reflections on Loch Ness from the Loch Shore. And our newspaper reviewers will be actively discussing the active farmer issue around land rezoning and the nitrates derogation. And of course, you can contact us as always by texting 51551 or email countrywide@rte.ie. And first this morning, Stephen Robb, renewables editor with the Irish Farmers Journal, and James Delahunt, a partner in corporate finance in KPMG, join me in studio for a conversation about anaerobic digesters and their future with Irish farms. But before we go there, over the last few weeks from afar, we've been talking, watching, listening and dreaming all things Olympics. And now it's time for Ireland's 35 Paralympians to join that excitement. So I am delighted to say that this morning, one of them joins me live on the line from Paris. Good morning, Katie Leonard. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. We're delighted to have you.
Good morning, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Kerry, now you are from the Royal County Meath and you're representing Ireland in the archery. You arrived in the Olympic Village just a couple of days ago. Tell me, what's the atmosphere like? Is the excitement building?
Oh, for definitely. This is the calm before the storm. I have the experience of Tokyo behind me, so definitely have a comparison between the two games. And there's a lot, it's very relaxed here in terms, you know, in comparison to Tokyo, where everyone was so stressed about catching COVID, but it's really friendly and everyone's just raring to get going now, I think.
And you mentioned Tokyo there. You are experienced. I mean, you came ninth in Tokyo, which was incredible. You're the national champion here in Ireland. But I'm wondering, you know, a lot of us listening at some stage or other, usually as children, will pick up a bow and pretend to be Robin Hood going around there. But you are the expert. So tell me about the moment when you lift up the bow, you pull back the bow line and you see the target. I mean, do you get a moment of complete calm? Are you nervous? What's it like?
I think, you know, it changes from shot to shot. You're always looking for that to be in that zone and for everything to fall away. And for the most part, it does. But, you know, emotions do come into your head. And in those moments, you have to trust that you've done enough practice and that you have the ability to shoot that middle of the target and come away with the win. So you're always hoping for everything to be zoned out and for you to be in the zone, but you can't anticipate it, especially when you're at, you know, on the world stage representing your country.
Yeah, well, it must be just an incredible feeling. I know you've been practicing so hard as well. And even throughout COVID, you had a target practice set up. I think, was it on the farm at home? Tell us a little bit about the farm in Meath. What kind of animals do you have there?
Yeah, I had an entire training facility at home. So we have organic beef and suckler. So it's there in the heart of the Royal County, as you say. It was really helpful during COVID and during Tokyo for my training, because where everyone else needed to adhere to that 5K bubble, I had the space to be able to train. Now, you do need a lot of space when it comes to archery. If you're shooting for the Olympics, for instance, you shoot 70 meters. And then for the Paralympics, you have the option of whether you shoot 70 meters with exactly the same bow setup as those in the Olympics, or there's an additional bow option called a compound bow, and you shoot that at 50 meters. So you do need a lot of space. And thankfully, with the setup at home, I'm able to achieve that.
That's a benefit. I hear you keep your dad on track with the paperwork in terms of the organic farming as well.
I do. Well, I keep him on his toes because, you know, he's very worried about me training on the farm. I have to remind him that, you know, I have represented my country at a Paralympic Games. His animals are safe and sound. And then I think to calm him down a bit more, I do help with all of the paperwork in the run-up to any inspections or moments where he needs a bit of a dig out.
That's very good of you. You've used your platform as well as a Paralympian to communicate your own message about farm safety. Now, you live with mm-hmm. spinal injury from a fall from a tractor when you were just 6 years old. I mean, we're not going to mm-hmm. go too far into that now because you are facing a competition. But, you know, what is the message out there that you want to try to share with farmers who might be listening?
Yeah, I think for me, I definitely prefer to use my platform to raise awareness around farm safety. I think for a lot of people, you know, the idea of that complacency isn't maybe fair to farmers because there's a lot of pressure, I know. But a lot of the stories you would expect to see around farm safety are older men potentially. And for me, I had my injury when I was six. So it is definitely a shock factor, if nothing else, to see a young woman discussing issues around farm safety. My biggest thing is that, you know, farming, typically you don't work on a farm, you work on the family farm. It's always accompanied with that word alongside it. And it's not about removing the family completely from that, because you want to ensure that your children want to be around you and you want to have that close family bond and help when times are tougher in the year. But really it's about, as an adult, being very vigilant about what farm safety risks are around your property and your business, and ensuring that none of those are a risk to your family as a whole, so that you can continue to work and live successfully as a family.
Yeah, and I think your resilience really shines through there. And I know everyone's going to have their fingers crossed for you. So, Kerry, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And we wish you and the Paralympian team just the very best as you head into the Games, and enjoy every minute of it. And remember, for everyone listening, from next Wednesday until the 8th of September, there will be coverage of the Paralympics Paris 2024 here on RTE Radio 1, with special programming on RTE 2 Television and the RTE Player. But now, renewable energy is becoming an increasingly hot topic, and biomethane is part of our national targets. Now, it's where slurry and silage are taken from farming and put through a process of anaerobic digestion, or AD. It's been incredibly successful in other farming-focused countries such as Denmark, where excess slurry can be an issue. Over there, some 25% of the natural gas in the gas grid is biomethane, which aims to be then up to 100% by 2030. However, our AD sector is not even really at the races in comparison. But in Northern Ireland, there are more than 70 farm-scale anaerobic digesters at work. I went to one at the Agri-Food and Biosciences Centre, AFBI, in Hillsborough, County Down, where I met their renewables expert, Chris Johnston.
This is basically all a massive mixing system, because it's kind of important to mix everything up in that reactor. It's possible to get as much biogas produced. You feel the temperature of that. It's really, really quite warm.
It's quite pleasant, actually, isn't it?
On a cold day, it's lovely being up here. But that's about, I think we run at about 39 degrees. But it varies between that, you know, 38, 41, something around that. But so as long as you've got really good mixing, you want to mix that enzyme and substrate. All the bugs are growing away in there furiously.
We're piling in slurry at the silage. Yeah.
We're giving as much food as possible. So ultimately, we'll get as much biogas produced we possibly can do, which comes up the little pipes here at the top.
Yeah.
And then from those pipes, it then heads to the big green bag there.
That's amazing. You're overseeing kind of the renewable energy side here at AFBI in Hillsborough. And just to put it into context, though, how big are the giant tanks in front of us? And there seems to be three of them, and then a massive green dome as well. It looks very futuristic.
Yeah, well, this is actually a small AD plant. The majority of the AD plants we have in Northern Ireland at the moment are about 500 kilowatt electric.
They look like giant water tankers.
Well, they are. They're like water tanks, I guess. Just massive, great big tanks. But these are small. I mean, these are relatively small ones. This is just a feedstock tank, but that's a 600 cubic meter digester tank. And that's where all the digestion goes on. It's where the biology happens, where the gases are produced. The big green dome is just an inflated balloon of biogas. That's all that is. It holds the gas there. It's like a big sort of power battery.
You wouldn't want to light a match near it then?
Well, you wouldn't, and you shouldn't, but actually it should be safe because the gas is transported then down to the energy centre where it's converted into energy.
Well, I know slurry is a key component of this, so we might walk back down to the farm and see what's producing the slurry in the first place. Chris, we've walked into one of the sheds here and there's, I think it's fair to say, quite a lot of cattle in Aspey. It has quite a big dairy herd.
Yes, we do have a big dairy herd. How big it is, I need to get back to you. But we do have a big dairy herd. At this time of year, though, it's not housed.
I mean, it ranges in the hundreds, though.
Yes.
And I guess a part of the reason to have your digester on site is you produce a lot of slurry here as well. So does all the slurry from the cat that the cattle produce go into the digester?
Yes, we can put about 7,000 cubic metres or so of slurry through the digester every year. And then also, of course, we're talking about the management of slurry and manure and the nutrient recirculation of that particular material and how we can...
Because slurry is becoming a real problem in terms of when it's spread, where it's spread. So if it could go into something like this, that seems like a win-win.
Well, yes, in the fact that it is a route that is there, the slurry can certainly go towards AD plants, be transported towards large AD, where it can be valorized in terms of biomethane. Don't forget all the nutrients still there, though. All the nitrogen's still there, all the phosphorus is still there. So that still has to be managed at the back end of the AD plant.
You were involved in a study with Queen's University.
Yeah, no, I think that piece of work you're talking about was a modelling exercise. It was more or less to sort of investigate if we were to start to redirect excess slurries, excess nutrient, and also top it up with silage as well.
Good quality silage, good, has to be.
Good quality silage, but silage nonetheless. If we were to start to do that and make a concerted effort to try to displace as much of the gas grid as possible from fossil gas with biomethane, how far could we get? And I think the modelled exercise showed that we could get up to about 80%. Those were based on 2017 values from memory. So could we displace 80% of that fossil gas with biogas? That was the question, and it looked as though we essentially could. This is a sector that has the opportunity for a massive amount more development.
So potentially you could supply 80% of Northern Ireland's gas demand from AD plants?
Through the modelling we did. Practice could be different, and we know we're starting to have a look at that in practice as well.
In the future, do you see this being led by farmers or by big companies?
I would like to think this should be led by farmers and farmer cooperatives. I think certainly with the development of new facilities, I think the farmers will very much be vital to its success.
I guess it's strange when you draw a comparison between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. There's, what, at least 70 AD plants across Northern Ireland in comparison to, I think, barely 20 down south of the border. Explain to me, why are you so far ahead, do you think?
Well, whether we're ahead or not, the scale of AD development then came along as a development from the renewable obligation certificates. So it basically subsidised the production of electricity from the generation through an AD plant. So that made it worthwhile, and that encouraged an investment. And yeah, you're right, we probably have 70, 80, 80 plus AD plants of a farm scale running in Northern Ireland. We've also got AD plants running on, you know, large scale food waste or even agricultural waste, other agricultural waste as well, such as poultry. But that would be the main reason for it. I think some of the differences we're going to see going forward, both sides of the border, is it's not going to be about electricity generation, you know, at source. It's going to be about biogas cleanup, production of biomethane injection into the gas grid. And then, of course, we've got an energy supply that we can use in all sorts of aspects, whether it's production of power, heat, transport, who knows.
That was Chris Johnston on the AFBI Research Farm in County Down. Now, James Delahunt, through your work with KPMG, you advise investors and policymakers about the issues with biomethane. We have about 20 AD plants here at the moment, but from where you're sitting, where do you see the future of this sector and what's going to happen next?
Good morning, Anne. Thanks very much for having me on. And good morning, Rob. So in relation to the industry, people would have seen in May, the government announced a national biomethane strategy. That essentially sets out a target of 5.7 terawatt hours of biomethane production by 2030. That's about 10% of today's natural gas use. In order to deliver that, the country needs about 200 to 250 of these biomethane plants to be developed and constructed right across the country, and then obviously for the biomethane to be injected into the grid. In order to deliver that, what's been stopping us so far has been essentially a viable route to market that developers can have confidence in to ultimately develop these. How that's going to be introduced is later this year there's going to be a thing called the Renewable Heat Obligation to be announced, or the RHO. That will essentially put an obligation on utilities to procure up to 10% of their gas from biomethane. That'll effectively then give confidence for people to go and develop a plant that they know that they'll be able to sell and that they'll be able to get the funding and bank. In addition to that, the strategy outlined that there'll be a 40 million euro grant capital facility. That's live now, and I was reading about Rob a couple of, or Stephen a couple of days ago in relation to the Farmers Journal about outlining that and some of the challenges and practicalities, but we're seeing developers go and submit applications for them at the moment.
And we did get a statement from the Department of Agriculture on this. They had 43 expressions of interest when the scheme was announced. It's a 40 million euro scheme. It was announced in June. We don't know how many applications there have actually been, and the application deadline I think closes at the 30th of August, and your planning permission has to be cleared by the 13th of September. Stephen, I guess it was outlined there very well by James, you know, what the plans are, but is there enough infrastructure, is there enough funding to actually get us there? We've barely 20 plants. What do we need over 200?
Yeah, look, this our 2030 targets, Hannah, of 200, 250 new build biomethane projects is going to be incredibly, incredibly challenging to meet, if not the damn near impossible. We're slowly but surely, very slowly putting the pieces together to outline that blueprint, that roadmap as such as to how we might be able to do this. But what's happening on the ground, it's a lot slower than what it needs to be. I guess that the big difference between Northern Ireland and the Republic here is that we're taking it a step further. Northern Ireland, they're producing biogas, make electricity, export to the grid. Here in the Republic, we're taking the biogas, we're upgrading it into biomethane, making it more or less chemically identical to natural gas and getting it into the gas grid. There's a lot more work involved in that. There's a lot more expense involved in that. They're much bigger projects. And that's why it's, in part, that's why it hasn't happened here as of yet. So the challenge ahead of us to come close to meeting our 2030 targets are massive.
Very difficult. I guess there are farmers, there are non-farmers and farmers listening. James, you are the son of a Wicklow beef farmer, and a lot of farmers listening are going to think, well, great, it could take a huge amount of slurry. I think it's the slurry from 1.3 million cattle. I think it's from all the winter slurry, which would be about 20% of all winter slurry in Ireland. It also needs silage. Now, the two things about silage, will farmers get paid, James, for their silage? How much could they get paid? But could it also swallow some of the silage stocks that could be going to animals?
Yeah, so I think that's a very good point. Like, where are the opportunities for farmers in relation to this? It depends on the farmer's level of appetite, their risk appetite, their financial resources. It'll vary from individual farmers that will look to enter into potentially a long-term contract for the sale of their grass silage and the supply of their slurry. We can see grass silage, while it ultimately needs to settle a 40 euro a tonne of what's ability to sell it, that's a nice premium as to what you might be selling it in other areas. And then you're seeing some farmers that will host plants essentially on their land through a land lease, or indeed some farmers may come together to ultimately look to seek to develop and construct one of these plants. So that's kind of one. In terms of the other question of, well, is it displacements? Is this effectively taking grass from the mouth of animals? One of the key things to appreciate in anaerobic digestion biomethane is if you enter into a contract as a farmer, you can then have a contract for the digestate, the offtake. That can be pelletized and is effectively an organic fertilizer. And what Chagas would be promoting is that you can ultimately use this to optimize effectively the yield of your land. So if we were to put in our 5.7 terawatt hours tomorrow, the amount of grass that would require is effectively 3% of the national land use. So this is not going to displace beef. It's not going to displace dairy. The objective that Chagas would say is, look, it's going to, if we optimize yield, it's an alternative route, it's a stable route, and it's a long-term contract that's available to farmers.
Stephen, coming back then, I guess, to the scheme that was announced, there's 40 million euro there, up to a maximum of 5 million euro per project, or 20% of the costs. But how much does an AD plant actually cost to build?
You see, this is the thing, again, go back to Northern Ireland, typical AD plant, farm scale, 3 million, give or take, back in the day. A lot of money, but actually quite doable for a farmer to do, especially when a long-term support scheme was in place. here in the Republic, because they're much larger projects, you're chatting between 10, 20, 30 million euro plus, depending on the size of the project and the scale of the project. So that's why these are large pieces of infrastructure, but the industry is happening. We're not going to meet our 2030 targets, but there are projects which will be developed probably by next year and up and going by next year. And that's why it's such a live issue. You mentioned 43 expressions of interest. Our figures would say there's probably about 17 of those projects which may be eligible to actually secure the funding. Realistically, we reckon about 5 of them or so might get through and actually get the funding.
It's tiny.
It's tiny. And these are the projects that have been worked on for a long time that are damn near shovel ready and ready to go. But they will be the ones that are going to be interacting and engaging with farmers. It's probably difficult to put a price on anything, to be honest, especially the price of silage, James. But until we know what price they're going to get for their gas, because that's what dictates everything. We don't know what the price of biomethane gas is going to be yet. There's no one actively engaged or actively locked into a long-term
householders listening would be hoping it would bring down the price of gas, though. They would be hoping. And I guess farmers would be hoping it would be a way to get rid of excess slurry. Wouldn't they, James?
Yep, I think that's fair. And certainly in terms of slurry, it is a method of going excess slurry. We know there's particular regions where they have excess slurry supply. There's no reason that can't be going into centralised anaerobic digestion facilities. I think an important thing just for people to appreciate as well, when we talk about Northern Ireland, a key element of Northern Ireland's anaerobic digestion has been for to have biogas plants that's ultimately used for the production of electricity. Ireland is phenomenally successful at producing renewable electricity through onshore wind and solar. It's more efficient and it's more efficient for consumers, for retailers, ultimately through that way. Anaerobic digestion is a more expensive way of producing electricity. What the Irish government has done is taken a separate, a different strategy, which is biomethane. So it's the decarbonisation of our heat and gas sector. And if we can get the biomethane strategy implemented, if the renewable heat obligation is implemented correctly and we've a degree of policy certainty, like all these targets, they're a flag on a faraway hill. They stimulate activity. They may or may not be reached, but it will, without doubt, create levels of activity. I would say that we could ultimately surpass Northern Ireland. And just finally, an important thing to know in Northern Ireland, those biogas plants, a lot of them will be repurposing now to be biomethane plants to effectively follow what Ireland are doing in the world.
James, where does the farmer fit in? Can it be farmer led, or is the farmer a supplier?
I think there. If you talk about those 200 plants, a lot of those plants are going to be larger plants, as Stephen has outlined, such as like a 40 gigawatt hour plant is kind of set as, I say, an average benchmark. If you have a 200-300 acre farm, that probably won't be sufficient enough to build an anaerobic digestion facility of your own that's viable. But the idea would be you would effectively come together with a number of farmers together. That's if in terms of the owner operator one. I think what is probably going to be most common will be long-term contracts feeding into some of the larger ones that are going to be developed, and then some farmers land leasing them across the country. But ultimately, I think what is positive is this isn't a directive from the government as to what it's open for farmers to do it. It requires farmers. This ultimately won't happen without the skills, the land, and the resources of farming community.
Stephen, do you have a final thought to add to that?
So look, there's a very small number of farmers actively trying to get projects off the ground themselves. But James is right, the vast majority of farmers will be engaged in AD through feedstock supply. So look, ultimately, Hannah, what that means, it's a new market. It's going to be a new market for farmers, going to be a market for slurry. What we think is going to happen is we're going to see farmers come together and form feedstock cooperatives at which they will come together and supply these plants. What I would like to see is for these feedstock cooperatives to have a share in the projects, to have a share in the plants, and that's how the farmers can get into the industry.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Thanks to James Dale Hunt of KPMG. And stay with us, Stephen Robb. You'll be coming back to us later with the newspaper review. Let's take a break.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Now, about this time last year, the Copernicus satellite captured images from space of the green algae that spread across Loch Ness last summer. Loch Ness is the largest lake on the island of Ireland. But this green algal bloom revealed the scale of the water quality problem facing the loch and its catchment. Suzanne Campbell is no stranger to the area, and she went to visit some stakeholders to see how they are reacting to the new plans for the future of the loch, recently published by the North's Agriculture Minister, Andrew Muir. She began by talking to a former fisherman, Gary McElhain, who runs a tourism business called Loch Ness Stories.
The algae of last year, we've never seen anything like that. People didn't realise the extent of it until last year whenever they've seen the algae bloom. People sometimes need to see a thing before they realise it's actually as bad as it is. And last year really showed that to be the case.
I'm on the western edge of Loch Ney in Ballyronan Marina with Gary McGurlin. The lake is his living as a fisherman and tourist operator. Last year's environmental catastrophe was not a single event, but part of decades of pollution from agriculture, food businesses, septic tanks and water treatment runoff. In response, a report and action plan for Loch Ney has been launched by Agriculture Minister Andrew Murr.
If you think about a lake the size of Loch Ney, the largest on the island, everybody thinks this lock will be fit to observe all the pollution that we put into it and everything will be all right. Now, for a long period of time, I think the lock has been fit to do that, but we're at a saturation point now where it just cannot do it anymore. There's just too much nutrient. It's at breaking point, I suppose.
What's your reaction to the plan?
Well, I think it's a desperate state of affairs that it took Minister Muir 6 months to get that over the line and storm it. Like, we were facing an environmental catastrophe, so that doesn't fill you with much heart that going forward that the emphasis is going to be about speed and trying to readdress the situations of Loch Ney.
Loch Ney is a huge lake. It sits right in the centre of the north of Ireland there, and all of the water that flows in, all of the rain that rains over the land and within the Loch Ney catchment, as it were, it's the drainage of all the little minor watercourses into larger streams, of streams into rivers, of rivers into small lakes, of lakes into Loch Ney. It just all builds up and the catchment is enormous.
Michael Meehark, together with his wife Julie, farms suckler cows in land bordering on the loch, and Michael facilitates farmers in the Loch Ney environmental scheme. One of the biggest challenges in addressing nutrient runoff from farms and dwellings is the vast size of the loch's catchment area.
In fact, Loch Ney has an international catchment. We've got the catchment that goes into the south of Ireland, so it's into Clonus and Monaghan. There's a large area of catchment there. In the Mourne Mountains, the Antrim Hills, the Tyrone Mountains, the Sperrins, and right up into the Belfast Hills, the catchment is vast. So it's about 1.3 million acres of farmed land. Catchment's actually bigger than that when you take all the towns and all the built-up area. Mm-hmm. But about 1.3 million acres of farmed land. And that probably equates with an average farm size in the north part of Ireland to being 100 acres. That would equate to about 13,000 landowners on both sides of the border being within that catchment.
So you could be watching, as many of us were, the BBC spotlights on the blue-green algae in Loch Ney, the environmental problems here, and not think that it's anything to do with you if you're in Monaghan or up in the Mourne's, but in fact, it's all collecting in this lake.
It's all collecting, and Loch Ney is kind of like a sump. It sits there in the middle, and whenever the waters rush down into the loch, it sits, and then there's settlement out of that. Mm. So nutrients and phosphates coming down into the loch are depositing out onto the bottom, onto the bed of the loch, and around 62% appears to come from agricultural sources. Around 20% from wastewater treatment overflows, about 12% from septic tanks. Now, some years ago, around 2013, the government here initiated a going for growth strategy for farmers. And it's thought that that has contributed a lot to the intensification, maybe more slurry produced and so on. And latest figures show that within Northern Ireland, we are producing enough protein, cheese, milk, beef, all the rest of it, to feed 10 million people. We've a population of 1.9 million. And that's brilliant for farming. It's brilliant for the business. It's brilliant for exports. But we're left with the dung and the manure and, to put it bluntly, the crap that all those excess tons of protein are producing each year. And whether that's sustainable or not, whether there is the land area there to take that, absorb it and use it without there being runoff, I think that's the big problem.
Last year's crisis brought huge attention onto the pollution issue, which has been brewing for a very long time. But has it brought urgency to protecting the loch now? Gerry Darby from Loch Ney Partnership.
If you look at like strategies that we drew up, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, you probably won't see water quality there, you know. So we've all been caught on the hop to a certain degree, no less government. And because of the massive catchment that Loch Ney has, when the problem does rise, which it did last year, it's a big physical, in-your-face problem that everybody can see.
And the action plan, is there enough in it?
I think it's a really good start. The problem really is that it's not just Minister Moore who has responsibility for the water quality on the loch. So, for example, the Department for Infrastructure would oversee NI Water, and they probably contribute to about 24-25% of the nutrients that are going into Loch Ness. So there's an issue. And if you look at that plan, it says, yeah, we're going to sort of interact with NI Water and the Department for Infrastructure, but there's no real investment targets associated with that. So there could be a problem. The other smaller issue, but equally important, is septic tanks. So everybody's been farming, but they've forgotten that there's other people that are contributing. And when you look at septic tanks, that's all of us that are living in rural Ireland, you know. Mm-hmm. And I say rural Ireland, both north and south, because like about 10% of the catchment of Loch Ness is in Cavan and Monaghan as well, you know. It's important to note also.
Do you think that this issue, you know, negative as it is, has made people in the catchment more aware?
Yeah, there's a need for to get people on the ground far away from Loch Ness to remind them that this catchment that is close to their house or their farm does eventually come into Loch Ness and will affect it significantly.
And that was Suzanne Campbell at Loch Ness for Countrywide. Now, what it says in the papers is off air this week, so we have been bringing you an agricultural version of it. And this week I am joined by Niall Sargent, current affairs correspondent with The Currency, and Stephen Robb, who's the renewables editor at the Irish Farmers Journal. Now, the agricultural story, and that's been dominating, I guess, farmer and non-farmer press the last couple of days, is the proposal by the Minister for Finance, Jack Chambers from Fianna Fáil, to postpone the implementation of the new residential zoned property tax. Niall, we have heard a lot about land rezoning in this last week, and you wrote an in-depth article for The Currency on it. Can you give us a snapshot of what's going on?
Yeah, so just turned out to be good timing that we were looking into the issue. So this is going to be the new scheme that's coming in, basically to try to encourage sites that aren't been used to get developers to actually build on them for the housing crisis that we're in. So it'll be a tax at 3% of the market value of the land. It's, like I said, predominantly aimed at more brown zone sites in towns and cities to try to get them developed. But obviously the issue that's developed is farmland has also been accounted for in that. So if there's farmland that is zoned for residential and has connection with water, electricity, etc., it can fall under the net. And it turns out that there are a lot of active agricultural lands that is falling under it. So what we were looking at was appeals that are going in against this. So if you're...
No one has actually told me. There's been a lot of talk about active farmers, and I think everyone is in agreement that active farmland should not be taxed. If you look at like land, for example, that would be worth maybe €1 million, then a farmer is facing a tax bill of €30,000 a year, which would be crippling. Yeah. But no one has actually told me how many farmers are in this net. You looked at the number of appeals that farmers have put in. How many appeals have farmers put in?
So there's, from what we looked at, about 100 appeals came in just there before. There was a deadline of the 1st of August, and as usual, everything comes in one wave. So there's about 100 plus appeals that went in, mostly developers for sites, some individuals. But there's 14 appeals in relation to active farmland.
Just now, 14?
Yes, but that's only going to be a fraction of the reality of how many farmers getting caught up in this. Otherwise, it wouldn't be such a political snowball that's been developing over the last while.
And would everyone have been contacted by the local authority?
Yes.
So this has been going on for a while now.
Quite a few years. It's been in development. There was the vacant site levy that's about to be... This is the replacement for that. So there was issues around that with active farmland as well. They made some workarounds with the residential zone land tax. They kind of just restarted the whole thing and entered these problems again. So if your site is on the map, you will be contacted by the local authority. You have an opportunity to put in observation or submissions to say why you should not or be included in the tax net. Then if that's unsuccessful, you can go to On Board Pinála to appeal that. But you have to be realistic. Most farmers aren't going to have the time or the skills or resources to be able to bring a proper appeal to the planning authority to hire maybe a planning consultant. That's more expense. And also, there was an opportunity on the draft map as well And farmers did put in submissions, and all the ones that we looked at, they all got refused and said, look, it's zoned residential, it's connected, it doesn't matter to us if it's active farmland, that's the rules as they are. So it seems like quite an unfair system for an active farmer to have to potentially be looking at another fee to pay.
And I guess the counter argument is that we need 50,000 homes a year. We are in the midst of a housing crisis. Stephen, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's no surprise that they kick the can down the road another year. So in other words, it's another government's problem.
Yeah.
Because as you rightly said, this has been battering around for a long time. Like, this was a hot topic at the ploughing last year. So it was. And they still haven't been able to crack the nut.
It's been pointed out to me that the Taoiseach has been at more agricultural shows recently than most farmers. Is there thinking here that this is potentially a political tool maybe?
Oh, I think it has to be. Yeah, given how close we are to a potential election.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll leave that with the listeners to think about. The derogation, there has been a lot of talk about the nitrates derogation this week. Ireland's is due to expire on the 1st of January 2026, but we still don't even know about stocking rates for 2025. Can you sum up briefly, Stephen, what has the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue, announced, I guess, in the last week?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have the blueprint on how Charlie McConnellogue, our Minister of Agriculture, plans to retain the derogation, which as it stands is up in 2026. A lot of pressure building on it. In fairness, there's about, 10 points, give or take. A lot of them aren't new. For example, water quality advisors or a €60 million innovation programme. That was all announced or up and running already. We knew a lot about it, but it's still included in the plan, which is fair enough. Some of the new points, Hannah, I suppose, there is going to be a 70% grant available for farmers to build slurry stores to import slurry. So you might have a situation where a dairy farmer is potentially producing too much slurry. You'd have a tillage farmer who's not getting enough slurry, so they want to try and marry that relationship up. So a tillage farmer could get a 70% grant to build a slurry store, lock into a contract with a dairy farmer, and it potentially could work quite well. That's now open for applications. As well as that, there's going to be a separate grant aid scheme for livestock farmers, but really aimed at dairy farmers, for a 60% grant to build a slurry store, a nutrient storage store on their own farmyard. That should be open from January 2025. Well, probably the most boldest move in this plan is a proposed new and separate exempted development threshold for standalone nutrient storage facilities. So in other words, they want to bypass the planning rules and allow farmers to build a slurry store without having to go for planning. The reason for that being is that there's been an awful lot of objections.
I detected objections. A bit of a chuckle though when you were saying that. Do you think it's realistic?
I think it's going to be very challenging. I think it's going to be, like, we have planning exemptions in place for, you know, for some agricultural buildings, for solar panels or for small scale wind turbines. But look, I guess a slurry store, it's a different animal. So it is, yes, look, and target it in the right place for the right farmer, you know, it would be quite useful. But I just think it's going to be very difficult to get through.
Niall, when we talk about nitrate derogation, we're really talking about water quality. And I guess there was a piece there earlier about Loch Ness and the algal blooms there as well. And in terms of the EPA figures, with everything that's been announced, can we or do we stand a chance of reversing the water quality in Ireland and getting to where we need to be?
At the moment, I can't see that happening. I mean, there's been progressive reports from the EPA every year that there was one a few months ago which was saying we're kind of, the levels are flatlining or the same as they have, which you could say in one effect that might be seen as a positive thing in terms of it's not getting worse, but the problem is we're at such a poor level, it has to get better. And until it gets better, I can't see that there will be a continuation long term of having a derogation.
It is serious though, because, I mean, figures from a report that was written by Niall Hurston in the Farming Independent, over 40% of Cork's livestock are dependent on the derogation. That's a lot of livelihoods.
Yeah. No, it's a very significant impact coming down the line, and that's why these measures that have been brought in, they do seem kind of like a band-aid to a much bigger wound. Like, it's a longer term issue. Bringing in the grant aid, bringing in the storage is necessary. I know Niall Hurston looked at the issue around the slurry export issue and storage last year. We looked in depth at that as well. You know, there's so many issues on farms with storage that councils, when they inspect, that is one of the issues on water quality, that we don't have the proper storage. So we definitely need it. I guess the issue is you can have the storage, but at the moment, and you talked about earlier the issues around AED, there's no real other outlet apart from spreading on the land. When it spreads on land, that's when the water quality issues come into effect, not so much that we don't necessarily have the correct storage while an issue.
Well, I guess the idea of the storage, though, is to allow you to hold on to the slurry to such a point where you can actually use it when the grass is growing, exactly, and take it up, which is a good thing, in fairness.
Stephen, briefly, now you are a tillage farmer.
I am a tillage farmer.
But you do want to talk about the harvest. So tell us, how has it been this year?
Yeah, look, it's been challenging, so it has. Hannah, there's no two ways about it. We're, figures from Siobhan Walsh in the Farmers Journal say we're about 35% through or so in the harvest. Look, tillage farmers had a bad harvest last year, difficult back end, difficult spring, and now we're getting a difficult bloody harvest again.
But grass is slow for any farmer out there. Grass is slow,
but we're just not getting the run at harvesting, so we're not. So as well as that, we have a lot more spring crops this year, so the bulk of the harvest is still to come when the days are getting shorter and the weather's getting a little bit more broken. So it's still all to play for. The more worrying thing is that grain prices have taken a bit of a tumble this week. We had a very high cost year in the tillage sector. The crops that are standing in the field were a lot more expensive to grow, and we need a decent price to cover it. Now, we won't get the price, so we won't get the harvest price until October, so there's still time to recover, but it is a very worrying period, especially considering that we have a target to increase our tillage area up to 400,000 hectares by 2030, and yet it is another target which is going to be very difficult to meet.
But obviously the price of straw bales will still be very reasonable for all my fellow beef and dairy farmers.
Absolutely,
out there.
Absolutely. They will, Hannah, yeah.
Briefly then, Niall, just tell me, there have been animals trapped in County Wicklow, but it's a different form of trapping because it's kind of camera trapping, isn't it? Caught on camera.
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece in the Wicklow News there in the last week about, so essentially it's a project to setting up camera traps in the woodlands around Wicklow to see how many animals, wild animals that they can trap. It's based on a European project. UCD are running it with Rewild Wicklow involved as well. So it's a great project. They set up hundreds of traps, thousands of sightings. I guess the downside is the majority of sightings were of sika deer, which we know is a big issue, farming community, forestry as well. But on the positive side, the red squirrel is coming back. That was the second biggest sighting. And one of the reasons probably for that is because the pine marten is also showing a really good comeback in the mountains.
So some good news.
Positive,
there.
But deer are still dominant. So we do have issues to solve there.
And Stephen, very briefly, the donkey sanctuary in Donegal, because you brought the paper with you.
I sure did. This is a story by Donegal. Meehan in Donegal News. So we all know the pressure that livestock farmers are under with the cost of feeding straw, but what about the poor donkeys? So speaking to Donegal News this week, manager of the Donegal Donkey Sanctuary, Danny Donkey Curran, that's his name, spoke about just how expensive it was to nurse a donkey back to full health. He said this time last year we were paying €80 for a giant square bale of hay. In May we were paying €140 and it's starting off at €150 now, so please spare a thought for the poor donkey.
We will indeed. Stephen, Rob and Niall Sargent, thank you very much for that. Now, we've been talking non-stop about agricultural shows the last couple of weeks, and Douala Show is coming up, and it might be a long way from Tipperary to Wales, but Nigel Owens, the legendary rugby referee, will be at Douala Show wearing his hat at the livestock judge, as a loyalist judge. Good morning, Nigel. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Good morning. How are you?
And congratulations on your marriage earlier this month to your long-term partner as well. But that honeymoon phase is now over. And I know, as a fellow Hereford breeder, that you have been hard at work on the farm. But I guess, Nigel, you've spoken in the past about your nerves before big rugby matches. So I'm wondering, how do you feel now that you're about to step into the show ring? Because judging cattle can be formidable. You wouldn't want to underestimate it.
No, you wouldn't. That's for sure. I did it in a small show in back on the border in Wales and England about last season. So it's very, very new to all this, to be honest with you, Hannah. And yeah, it's a bit like stepping into Croke Park or into the Aviva Stadium to referee Ireland, or I want to referee Munster Leinster in Croke Park back in the European Cup in 2009 when there were about 84,500 packed in there. Stepping into that cauldron then as a pretty new experienced referee in the European Cup was a very daunting experience, but I think tomorrow's going to be just as daunting, I think, yes. But I'm looking forward to it very much.
Good. Well, it's good to hear you're taking it seriously, because we all know, especially Hereford breeders or all breeders, take these things very seriously. And
no,
I guess
we'll
know that there's now legendary rivalry between the southern and northern hemispheres when it comes to rugby. But it's funny how kind of almost a bit of that rivalry is creeping into Hereford breeding, because you probably know there's a horned Hereford versus a polled Hereford debate. Now, polled is, they're born hornless, for people who don't know, and it makes life a bit easier. Now, where do you stand on that? Would you be polled or would you be horned?
No, I got a bit of both, to be honest. I'm more polled than horned, but I do have about five or six horned cows, and I do then have a couple of heifers coming through. So, to be honest, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I guess. I think it's a balance, I think. And I do find that when you put a polled bull on a horned cow, you sort of keep a little bit of that sort of traditional type of the Hereford in it, but also as well it gives you a lovely animal as well. So yeah, I'm mostly polled, and probably will always be mostly polled, but I certainly do have a couple of traditional Herefords, even though I put the polled bull on them, and they tend to be polled, although you do get the odd skirt or the odd horn throwing back. I will still also put the horned bull on a couple of horned cows. I'll always have pure breed horned cattle in the breed.
Well, I can tell you, you're going to cause some debate now in the show ring tomorrow. But what do the Herefords?
Maybe remember, Hannah, the referee's final decision, the judge's final decision as well. And I got my cards with me, and I got my whistle, so I won't be taking any nonsense. Telling you now.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. And people can follow you on social media as well. Some of the Herefords you have are absolutely beautiful. I have to say, I have a Hereford envy. So Nigel Owens, thank you very much, and people can see you at Dualla Show tomorrow, which is in Cashel in County Tipperary. And of course there's Iverk Show as well, which is the longest running show in Ireland. There's my own local Limerick Show. I'll be refused entry later on if I don't mention that on as well. And for all the other information, there is irishshows.org. But that is our lot for this week. Thank you very much to all our guests and contributors. Thank you very much to the production team. We had Tommy O'Sullivan on sound. The BCO was Amandine Passo Devine. This programme was produced by Eileen Heron. Coming up after on the 9 o'clock news, it's Playback with Brian O'Connell, and it's my last week on Countrywide this week, so thank you very much for tuning in. Brenda Donoghue will be hot to go next week, but until we speak again, thank you all very much for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.